The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is John Ivey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the March 2019 issue of Sports Illustrated for Kids. We're going to begin today on page 8, and we have our last section of Who's Who in Sports. Ada Hegerberg, soccer. She's a striker of the Olympic Lyonnais. Her height is 5'9". She was born July 10, 1995, in Sundalasora, Norway. After leading Lyon to a third straight victory in the UEFA Women's Champions League, Hegerberg won the inaugural Women's Ballon d'Or as the best player in the world. During the 2017-18 season, Hegerberg scored 53 goals in 33 matches. She scored in the 103rd minute of the Champions League final, a 4-1 win over Wolfsburg. Hegerberg began her career at age 15 for Kolbotn, a team in her native Norway. At 16, she led the club in goals. Question: who won the men's Ballon d'Or for 2018? Do 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 do. Answer: Luka Modric. Next we have Mark Giordano, defenseman of the Flames. His height is 6'1". His weight is 200 pounds. He was born October 3, 1983, in Toronto, Ontario. Through January 14th, Giordano ranked first among NHL defensemen in plus-minus, plus 36, and second in scoring, 47 points. He also led the Flames in ice time, 24 minutes and 41 seconds. Originally undrafted, Giordano has played over 800 games for Calgary. He has been the team's captain since the 2013-2014 season. In 2017, Giordano won ESPN's Muhammad Ali Sports Humanitarian Award, in part for his work with the Team Giordano program, which helps high-need students in Calgary. Question: who was the Flames captain before Giordano? Do 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 do. Answer: Jerome Ignalia. And finally, Novak Djokovic, tennis player, ATP Tour. His height is 6'2". His weight is 170 pounds. He was born May 22nd, 1987, in Belgrade, Serbia. After an injury-riddled 2017, Djokovic staged a comeback during the 2018 season, winning Wimbledon in July and the United States Open in September. In November, Djokovic ascended to number one in the ATP rankings for the first time in 2 years. He had been as low as 22nd while recovering from elbow surgery. Through his foundation, Djokovic works to increase the number of children in his native Serbia who receive early childhood education. Question: who did Djokovic overtake to grab the number one ranking in November 2018? Answer: Rafael Nadal. Now we'll go to pages 42 through 45, Anatomy of an Upset. Last season, Maryland-Baltimore County shocked the college world when it knocked off number one Virginia the first time a number 16 seed has won an NCAA tournament game. How did the Retrievers pull off the ultimate upset? Those involved gave us the inside scoop. 1.4% UMBC win probability. Before the game, Virginia went 31-2 during the regular season, cruising into the tournament as a top seed. UMBC needed a game-winning three with 1 second left to win its conference championship game and clinch its berth. Almost no one, save for Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, picked the Retrievers in their bracket. But Coach Ryan Odom implored his team to not be afraid of the matchup. Our staff was very real with what we were facing, he says, but we said we're experienced. We've had some tough games. We've been down and come back. It wasn't the first time we've seen talent like that. 1.4% UMBC win probability. Game time. Before the 2018 men's tournament started, there had been 132 games between a 16 seed and a top seed. The lower seed lost in all instances. However, they have had slightly more success in the women's tournament. In 1998, 16th seed Harvard, on the right, defeated number one Stanford, 71-67. The Crimson remained the only women's squad to pull off the ultimate upset. So we have pictures here on pages 42 and 43 of the elation of UMBC and the degradation and the upset of the team from Virginia. Moving on, page 45, 19 minutes, 2 seconds left in first half. The UMBC win probability was 1.7%. College basketball writer and commentator Seth Davis has a tournament tradition. When a team is clearly going to win, he marks it on his bracket with a Sharpie. Often he's right. During this contest, with the game scoreless, he wrote this on Twitter, Virginia Sharpie. Suffice it to say, writing it in permanent marker wasn't the best idea, but with the Cavs holding a 98.3% chance of winning, can you blame him? 5 minutes, 22 seconds left in the first half. UMBC win probability, 4.1%. UMB has a saying, you can't win a game in the first half, but you can lose it. With Virginia leading 16-13, the Retrievers just wanted to keep it close. Our goal was to be in the game at halftime. Odom says UMBC benefited from the Cavs missing a number of shots, but the Retrievers played right tight defense and hit clutch baskets. It's just basketball at the end of the day, says Jarius Lyles, a guard who scored 28 points. Halftime. UMBC win probability 11.7%. The first half ended with the game tied at 21. Historically, many number 16 seeds who kept the game close in the first half wound up getting blown out when the game resumed. In 2017, for instance, St. Mary's trailed Villanova by 1 point and admission, and South Dakota State was down to Gonzaga by 4. Both 16 seeds ended up losing by 20. UMBC's challenge was to keep its hot start going. And from the coach of UMBC, our guys began to talk about it at halftime. We're 20 minutes away from history. Have no fear of failure. That was the mentality, Coach Ryan Odom. With 5:50 left in the second half, UMBC's win probability had now jumped up to 97.9%. Jarius Lyles was UMBC's big star all season. In the conference championship game, he hit the game-winning three to send the team dancing. And against Virginia, he was great, scoring a game-high 28 points. But when UMBC was leading 54-40, yes, Lyles Below began to suffer from cramps in his legs, and he still felt Virginia was in it. A lot of crazy stuff can happen in a short amount of time, Lyles says. But it wasn't just me out there. The cramps were bothersome. It didn't look like it out there, but I hate cramps. It's definitely a pain. Despite the pain, he scored 4 points in the final 5 minutes. 16 minutes, 24 seconds left in the second half. UMBC's probability of winning is now 53.9%. Joe Sherburn, the 6'6 guard, is known for his shooting, and he started the second half on fire with 6 points in the first minute. It was his three-pointer above, though, that gave UMBC a 35-24 lead and tilted the win probability in UMBC's favor for the first time. 11 minutes, 39 seconds left in the second half. 90% UMBC's win probability. UMBC didn't just hang in the game. The Retrievers began to pull away. But even with a 45-29 lead, Odom knew that there was still plenty of time left, and that Virginia was a number one seed for a reason. The message was, don't get tentative, Odom says. We encourage the guys to play forward. Every time Virginia hit a shot, UMBC responded with a bucket. We never took our foot off the gas, said forward Arkell Lamar. Then with 5:50 left in the second half, UMBC's win probability, 97.9%. Jairus Lyles was UMBC's big star all season. In the conference championship game, he hit the game-winning three to send the team dancing. And against Virginia, he was great, scoring a game-high 28 points. With 3 minutes 37 seconds left in the second half, UMBC's win probability now was at 99.8%. Instead of trying to run down the clock, Lamar left, launched a three-pointer from the corner with 20 seconds left on the shot clock to give the Retrievers a 61-44 lead. When I hit that shot, says Lamar, we were on fire. Guard Joe Sherburn, that was the dagger, speaking of Lamar's shot from the corner with 20 seconds left, a three. With 35 seconds left in the second half, UMBC's probability to win was now at 99.8%. With UMBC up 74-54, the game was, for all intents and purposes, over. The players were excited and Twitter was going crazy. One person who didn't think it was finished. Odom, I never relax, he says. You're focused on trying to get to that final horn. Never did I really think we had it in the bag. Maybe he should have. For the last 35 seconds, UMBC held onto the ball and reveled in the magnitude of its win. With 0 seconds left in the second half, UMBC's probability of winning, 100%. A Sports Illustrated cover is one of the most covered honors in sports, and UMBC's historic 74-54 victory was certainly cover-worthy. Instead of waiting until the next issue, SI decided that UMBC's accomplishment couldn't wait, so they honored the team with a special digital-only cover. As the only coach to lead a number 16 seed to victory, Ryan Odom has a blueprint for bench bosses hoping to do the same. 1. Coach your team like you have in every other game. 2. Have no fear of failure. Everyone's in the tournament for a reason. And 3. Don't just be happy to be there. Compete to win, no matter the odds. Moving on to page 46, picture here of Tennessee's Gary Williams playing against Gonzaga. Body of work, by shedding pounds and honing his game, Williams developed into the SEC's Player of the Year. These are from the pages of Sports Illustrated. Everything to prove. A hard-edged squad of underrated recruits led by a tap-dancing, chess-playing power forward has the Volunteers riding high and gunning for their first Final Four. You might call Grant Williams an overachiever. As a sophomore last season, the 6'7" forward was voted the SEC Player of the Year, less than three seasons after being a roly-poly, his words, three-star recruit from Charlotte. He chose Tennessee over Yale, Harvard, and Princeton, to the disappointment of his NASA engineer mother, Teresa Johnson, after building a future by Ivy League's extracurricular resume, studying a half-dozen instruments, including the violin and clarinet, tap dancing, a solo in Providence Day School's production of Anything Goes, attending STEM programs and chess tournaments, once being the nation's top-ranked youth in the latter. At Tennessee, he was initially a mechanical engineering major, then decided it was more important to graduate in 3 years and begin work on a master's. A minor in Spanish was dropped for similar reasons. Despite his fluency, in May he will receive his degree in supply chain management. He took 18 credits this fall to make that happen. In the spring, he'll take 17 more. His coach, Rick Barnes, appreciates his star's many talents. He lauds Williams' worldliness and depth. He praises his unselfishness as a player and his commitment to hosting recruits and attending all kinds of campus sporting events. But overachiever? Barnes has publicly called Williams soft. Tennessee's letdown and said that he is the definition of soft. The barbs are intended not to diminish Williams' basketball accomplishments, but to inspire even more of them, a tough love act Barnes has honed over decades. He's not even scratched the surface, Barnes says of Williams. When I see greatness in somebody, I want to get it. Of the 31 teams Barnes has coached in the 109 who have played for Tennessee, these Volunteers who are 13-1 have a chance to be the greatest yet. They are driven largely by the hard-nosed Williams, 18.8 points, 7.9 rebounds, 3.9 assists, and the tenacious clamp-down D of 6'6" senior wing Admiral Schofield, 18 points, 6.2 rebounds, 44.9% three-point shooting. Tennessee's all-upperclassmen lineup plays with a controlled, steady pace on offense while limiting mistakes and sharing the ball, assisting on 66.7% of field goals, and with an unrelenting physical defense powered by the urgency and focus of a group that can sense its time is now. Like Williams, Schofield was a less heralded recruit who has blossomed. Such a parallel is common on a team that a year after being pegged to finish 13th in the SEC and then tying for first, now has hopes of reaching the program's first Final Four. We're a bunch of 2- and 3-star guys, says Schofield, trying to make a name for ourselves. The primary reason recruiting analysts shortchanged Williams was structural. He entered college weighing 260 pounds with 17% body fat, and at his high school height of 6'4", there were concerns that his old-school post-game would not translate against larger elite competition. Grant sought to counteract this by telling people he was 6'8". I felt like I was, well, I was, Williams says. The first time Barnes saw Williams play in an AAU showcase, the coach recalls Williams made a Barkley-like spin move from the short corner and skied for a dunk. That convinced me that there was an athlete inside that body, Barnes says. Unleashing it required Williams to spend as much of his freshman year in what he calls fat camp, a series of additional cardio workouts before and after practice. He is now around 235 pounds, though still not safe from Bard's ego-checking. After Williams won the SET's top individual honor last spring, Barnes told him that based on the team's play down the stretch, the award could have easily gone to Schofield. When Williams was selected as the league's preseason player of the year this fall, the coach pointed out that no preseason pick has ever won the year-end trophy. The best thing you can do for people is tell them the truth, Barnes adds. He's a coach who knows the value of hearing what you might not want to. The common narrative goes like this. Over 17 seasons at Texas, Barnes' teams underachieved, as evidenced by six straight early March exits. After he was forced out in 2015, Knoxville offered a refreshing change of scenery, and voila, the coach was reinvigorated, hence the Vols' success. But to hear Barnes tell it, his most vital change came long before he left the Longhorns. Barnes had risen quickly as a coach. After one season at George Mason at 34, he was hired at Providence in 1988. When coaching legends such as Lou Carnesecca, Raleigh Massimino, and John Thompson ruled the Big East, he compensated with maniacal preparation and relentless practices, no out-of-bounds, the late-night sessions on the eve of day games. The Friars reached the three NCAA tournaments in six seasons before Barnes decamped for Clemson, another minnow in a powerful conference pond. In 3 years, the hard-driving Barnes took the Tigers to the program's first number two ranking. Texas, too, reached new heights under Barnes. Before his arrival, basketball had long been a football school afterthought. In 2003, Barnes took the Longhorns to their first Final Four since 1947. Barnes lured future pros such as Kevin Durant, LaMarcus Aldridge, and T.J. Ford to Austin. He scouted at ungodly hours, took game prep home with him. Guilt enveloped him whenever he wasn't recruiting. Losses back then, recalls a UT Arlington coach and former Longhorns assistant, Chris Ogden. You ran the other way if you saw him coming down the hall. It was a level of obsession Barnes now describes as consumed. I mistook activity for achievement, he says. I was chasing all the wrong things. Most people probably thought I was a pretty good guy, but there was an inner arrogance. The wake-up call came from his daughter, Carly, about a decade ago. She told Barnes, a lifelong churchgoer, that he had lost sight of what is important. Barnes was floored. Soon he was also grateful. He remained demanding of his players but stopped cursing at them. He reached out to former pupils to make amends. As the number of signature wins declined, the Longhorns did not get past the first weekend of March Madness after 2008, and criticism swirled in media and fan circles. Barnes kept his keel even. Finally, he was given an ultimatum. He could keep his job only if he fired his staff. Barnes chose to leave. He is asked now whether his success at Tennessee is at all enabled by it no longer defining him. I'm not about success, Barnes says. It has nothing to do with success. But that's not to say he's devoid of ambition. You think about Kentucky and Carolina and how they've been there every year, he says. We're a read right now. If we don't want to be part of that, we should be doing this. When Schofield was choosing between offers from Tennessee and West Virginia, Kentucky offered inspiration. He was miffed that the blue blood never came calling. Going to Knoxville would offer the opportunity to play and beat the Wildcats, which the Vols have, four times in seven meetings during Schofield's three-plus seasons. As conference play looms, it's the Volunteers who are looking like the SEC's measuring stick, a status more in line with their collective self-image than their ratings as recruits. With a coach that's a realist himself, that's real with us day in and day out, we have a good perception of who we are, says Schofield. Their mentality, he says, is that it's not like we're stepping on the court with you. You're stepping on the court with us. This is a throwback Rick Barnes team, says Fran Fraccella, an assistant to Barnes at Providence and now an ESPN analyst, to the days he was climbing and fighting his way up. Williams told Barnes upon his commitment to Tennessee that he wanted to hang banners, a process that began last season with the Volunteers' first regular season conference title in a decade and just their third since 1982. The goal now is larger and more enduring. We want to be one of those programs where every single year it's like, oh, Tennessee, says Williams. not just, oh, they had a good team, they had a good run. In other words, they want not just to win, but also to keep winning and have no one call them overachievers. End zone. What's the call? Number one, bad reception. In a baseball game between the Akron Arachnids and the Toledo Termites, Akron manager Mark Driver calls his bullpen coach Drew Miller and tells him to get lefty reliever Bob Michaels warmed up. Miller, however, mishears his boss and thinks Driver said Bob Michaels. Coincidentally, the name of the other pitcher in the Arachnids bullpen. Driver leaves the dugout and signals for the new pitcher before notifying the umpire of the substitution. After Beichels takes his place on the pitching rubber, however, Driver tells him to go back to the bullpen, get Michaels. The Termites protest, saying the substitution has already been made. You're the umpire. Can Michaels and Beichels switch? What's the call? What's the call? No. Michaels has to pitch to at least the next batter. Since the substitution was not announced, it became official when Michaels took his place at the pitcher's plate. Number two, friendly fire. The Brooklyn Jacks and Queens Kings are playing a football game under NFL rules. The Jacks are lined up for a short field goal. Brooklyn kicker Teddy Leadfoot boots a low drive kick that eventually grazes the helmet of long snapper Hud McGinnis before clearing the uprights. Leadfoot celebrates a made field goal, but the Kings protest that the Jacks can't kick the ball off their own player. Do the points count? Answer, the kick is no good. The ball cannot hit the ground or a player on the offensive team before it clears the uprights. And finally, chip shot. Victoria Stevens is playing in a golf tournament under USGA rules. She hits her ball from the fairway and it lands on the putting green. After the ball comes to rest, however, a chipmunk named Ernie knocks it further from the hole. Is Stephanie allowed to move the ball back, or does she have to play it from where Ernie moved it? Stevens can move the ball back. If an animal makes the conditions of the shot worse, the golfer can try to restore the original conditions as nearly as possible. We've run out of time for today's program of SI Kids. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Down the street, I observed this lovely lady that I wanted to meet. I walked up to her, I said hello. She said, hey, you're kinda cute. I said, yes, I know, but by the way, sweetheart, what's your name? She said, my friend's like